Good morning. I think we'll try to get started on time. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest speaker, Dr. Amy B. Schiffman. Dr. Schiffman went to Columbia School of Engineering, and she actually, medicine is actually a second career. She practiced as an engineer for 20 years before enrolling in medical school at age 40. She went to the FAU, University of Miami Combined Medical School Program, and then did her internal medicine residency at University of Miami, and did her allergy fellowship in Tulane. She practices allergy and immunology here in South Florida. She gave us a wonderful lecture on penicillin allergy, and she happens to be the proud mother of six children. She's very active in the Academy and College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, and this morning's topic is preventing suicide. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Schiffman.
Thank you. Hi, good morning. Welcome. First, I really want to thank all of you for being here. This is not an easy topic. Sometimes it's a little... Again, thank you for joining me. This is not an easy topic, and sometimes it's a little statistic heavy, but it's really an important topic, and I'll share with you in a moment why I became interested in it. And I have no disclosures. So today we're going to look at the epidemiology and the risk factors for suicide. We're going to examine two important publications, the World Health Organization publication and the Action Alliance Research Task Force publication. We're going to look at strategies for suicide prevention and evaluate the efficacy of these prevention strategies. And then toward the end, we're really going to highlight physician risk for suicide. So here's a number of photos of various celebrities. We're looking at Drew Barrymore, Halle Berry, Paris Jackson, Elton John, Owen Wilson, and Britney Spears. So can anyone guess what the unifying factor is? Attempted suicide, correct. And here we have Anthony Bourdain, Robin Williams, Kurt Cobain, Kate Spade, and Alexander McQueen. And I think we all know that these are people that actually succeeded in suicide. So what is the allergist and immunologist doing up here talking about suicide and suicide prevention? So attempted suicide has touched my life, and as a third year a resident, we all had to give senior presentations, and this is something that I became interested in. And now, pretty much on a yearly basis, wherever I am, I try and give this lecture. I update it with the most recent facts and statistics and research, and it's sort of a pet project of mine. So, every 40 seconds, a person dies by suicide somewhere in the world. So unfortunately, despite being a leading cause of death worldwide, suicide has remained a low public health issue and priority. And research and prevention haven't received the financial or human interest needed. So the World Health Organization and the Suicide Action Alliance got together, and they both, well, they didn't get together, but they each published important publications in 2014. So this was the World Health Organization presentation, and it presents the latest data on suicide worldwide, prevention efforts, and identifies evidence-based approaches to prevention that can be adapted in different settings. Essentially serving as a building block for development and implementation of strategies. So this was published in March of 2014 to coincide with World Suicide Prevention Day. And its aims are to increase awareness of public health significance of suicide and suicide attempts, to make suicide prevention a higher priority on the global health agenda, and to encourage and support countries to develop or strengthen comprehensive suicide prevention strategies. So this was published in 2014. I sort of updated a lot of the statistics to the latest that we have available. So as of 2017, about 800,000 suicide deaths worldwide. So per 100,000 individuals, that comes to about 15 males and 8 females per 100,000 individuals. The male-female ratio is very interesting. In higher-income countries, there's a significant male-to-female skewing of that ratio with about 3-to-1. But in lower-to-middle-income countries, the ratio is much more equivalent or even, coming down to about 1.5-to-1 for male-female. And we think that those numbers are actually underrepresented. In a lot of countries, suicide is stigmatized. It's actually illegal in some countries, and the data is very difficult to obtain, and we lack high-quality vital registration systems in a lot of the world. When we look at suicide attempt rates, we think that at least 3-to-1, and maybe higher, as far as rates compared to successful suicides. The suicide rate is highest for persons aged over 70 years old, so in the older population. And globally, it's the leading cause of death in the younger population, those 15 to 29. And the three most popular methods are ingestion of pesticides and hanging, because those are very inexpensive and easily accessible, and firearms, because in this country, they're easily accessible and very prevalent. So of all the data that I have, the most recent data that I obtained, which was from the AMA a couple weeks ago, is that there were 24,000 or close to 24,000 suicides by firearm in the last year. And there were 40,000 deaths by firearms. So a significant portion being suicide and a significant number of death by firearms. This is looking at the age-standardized suicide rates across the world. So the darker the color, the more suicides in those countries. So about close to 80%, 78% of suicides occurred in low- and middle-income countries. And I'm going to talk about why it's more prevalent in these countries. But of those lower-income countries, 40% in China and the former Soviet Union, and about 25% in the higher income countries. And overall, it's about the 17th leading cause of death in the world. So the World Health Organization said, let's approach the suicide and suicide prevention using the public health model. So the public health model is a four-step process. So first is surveillance. We have to know what the problem is in order to be able to address it. So getting good data, good surveillance. Second is identifying both risk and protective factors. So we want to know who's at risk and who isn't at risk, or what items can buffer the impact of these higher risks. Then develop and evaluate interventions. So what type of interventions work? For whom does it work? And then implement them initially on a narrow spectrum, and then broaden that spectrum to see if these interventions are effective. So four main global risk factors have been identified: health system, society, community, and individual. And we're going to look at those. So from a health system standpoint, overall, receiving health care is difficult, both for accessing it and receiving it. And when it comes to mental health, it's even more difficult, as the mental health system is fragmented in a number of countries, including our own. From a society standpoint, I already alluded to easy availability of means and the fact that we have unregulated handgun ownership here, contributing to 24,000 deaths last year. Also, inappropriate media reporting. So often suicide is glamorized, and that conveys a more socially acceptable occurrence. And there's stigma against those who seek help. From a community standpoint, anything that contributes to anxiety, stress, instability is a community risk factor. So war, disaster, discrimination, violence, PTSD, any prolonged or abusive state contributes to the risk factors. And from an individual standpoint, by far the largest individual risk factor is prior suicide attempt. So this is the first time you're going to hear me say this, but I'm going to say this over and over. Asking someone, a patient, a friend, anyone that you know, are they contemplating suicide? Have they attempted suicide before? Do they have suicide ideation? Does not contribute to that, to their risk factor. So you can ask. It's not going to cause it. It's not going to contribute. It's not going to make them think about it more. It's identifying a problem. And that's what we need to do. We need to identify who's at risk and then address that issue. Individually, mental illness contributes. Substance abuse is a significant contributor, both alcohol and, at this point, opioids, crisis, and family history. And we'll look at each of those a little bit more in depth in a moment. So I was talking about the world suicide statistics, and now I'm going to sort of focus on the U.S. So in the United States, 45,000 Americans died by suicide. Does anyone know how many died by homicide over the same period? 20,000. So less than half died by homicide. So also a very significant difference. So we've addressed homicide with a lot of both financial and personal investment, and it's achieving. A reduction as far as numbers. Now we have to invest that time and effort and money into suicide, and maybe we can also impact those numbers as well. 500,000 people are treated in the emergency department for self-inflicted wounds, and over a million people reported a suicide attempt. And again, we think that reporting is very underrepresented. So if a million people report it, we're thinking anywhere from 2 to 9 million people actually had those thoughts in the last year. And it is the second leading cause of death among adolescents and young adults, so anyone from age 10 to 34. So what is the impact of suicide in the U.S.? Well, there's a significant economic impact. We estimate that it's close to, this is per the CDC, about $3 billion a year in medical care costs for suicides and suicide attempts. If you factor in indirect costs, lost wages, lost productivity, that number goes up to about $5 billion. There's an estimate that every individual suicide costs our society between $1 and $2 million. And that's the financial impact. The social impact: every suicide that occurs intimately affects at least 6 individuals. And then you have the secondary impacts and the tertiary impacts. So there's a very broad impact from a social standpoint that these suicides have. And one of the reasons that I'm here talking to you is that as a primary care provider, we have critical roles. So almost half of individuals who died by suicide saw their primary care provider in the prior month, and almost all of them had seen a primary care provider in the last year. So these are opportunities that we all have to, when we speak with our patients or when they're checking in, if you have the ability to address a mental health issue, then you ask the question, have you contemplated suicide in the last year? Do you have any suicidal ideations or thoughts? Looking overall at the causes of death, so the top two, heart disease and cancer, but suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. That's very, very preventable. And these numbers keep going up. So this is the most recent bar graph that's available, and you can see that the suicide rate increased by 0.3% between 2014 and 2015. If you look at the suicide rate by years, You see there's a nice drop from between about 1990 to 2000, went from about 12.5 to 10.4 individuals per 100,000. But in the last really close to 20 years, that number has been increasing steadily. So this bar graph sort of ends at 2013, but I put in 14, 15, and 16, and the numbers still keep increasing. So whatever we've been doing hasn't been working, because all of these suicides are not only continuing to occur, but increasing. And then looking at the suicide rates by age distribution, you can see that the greatest age distribution is age 45 to 54, closely followed by the 85 and older. The younger individuals, so less than 15, and even the 15 to 24, they have the lowest numbers as far as suicide rate. However, they have the younger people attempt suicide at a rate of about 25 to 1 compared to, so attempted suicide compared to successful suicide. There's much, much more suicide attempts by the younger individuals. Older individuals, it's actually more lethal, so it's about 4 to 1. So for every 4 attempts, there's actually a succeed. And then looking at the age or the gender distribution, you can see that in our country, which is a higher income, that it's much more skewed to male. So males are about 20 compared to 5.5 for women. However, again, like the younger and older people, women, the attempted suicide is also much greater, about 2 to 3 times that of the male rate. It's just that males are more successful, so they choose more lethal ways of and they're successful in their attempts, as opposed to women, that there's a lot more overdose. So men tend to choose firearms, which are much more lethal than overdose. And then focusing just down to Florida, this is a very nice slide that's provided by the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention. Compared to the national statistics, we're right about there. Everything is pretty much close to the national statistic. So in the state of Florida, someone dies about every 3 hours from suicide. There's about twice as many people who die by suicide compared to homicide. It costs the state of Florida $2.8 billion in combined lifetime medical and work costs, and we're again about the average of about $1 million per suicide. It's the second leading cause of death in those aged 25 to 34, and third in a little bit younger population, so the 15 to 24. And the rate per 100,000 is close to 14, so a little higher than the national average, but about middle for the number of states. So other than the CDC, there's actually a statewide repository for collecting data. And the nice thing about the state-based surveillance is they link variables. So their goal is the who, when, where, and how of the death to be able to link it to the why. So they look at 5 different manners of death: homicide, suicide, unintentional firearm, undetermined intent, and legal intervention. And then they look at the manner, mechanism, circumstances, and victimology to try and link why this occurred. They get input from multiple sources of documentation, so law enforcement, the legal system, coroners, doctors, ER physicians, and they sort of put it all together with their goals of collecting and analyzing data to monitor the occurrence, to provide insight on the reasons why these violent deaths are occurring, use that information to develop, implement, and evaluate programs, to build and strengthen partnerships within the communities and the states, and to track progress of those programs. So overall, looking at the methods of injury, about half by firearms in the U.S., and then a quarter by hanging strangulation, and about a quarter by sort of the combined everything else. So the poisoning and the jumping off different buildings and suffocation and things like that. Looking at the national repository from 2016 and identifying the why or the circumstances leading to some of these deaths, they were able to perform toxicology in anywhere from about 50 to 75% of the individuals. So alcohol was in the decedent's system about a third of the time. Opioids about a quarter of the time. And actually most interesting to me was that a quarter of the time there was presence of SSRI. So antidepressants were present in the blood of a quarter of suicide victims. So they're receiving some help, but it's just not adequate enough to treat what's going on with them. A lot of mental health problems. I'm going to look individually at the different mental health disorders on the next slide. Recent crisis. So any sort of crisis, work crisis, marriage crisis, personal, interpersonal conflict, all of those things, health problems, financial problems, all of that directly contribute to individual risk factors for suicide. So looking at mental illness, about 75% had a diagnosis of a major depressive disorder. And then there were also a number of other mental illnesses that were associated, so bipolar disease, schizophrenia, anxiety, and PTSD being the most likely. Close to half of them had a diagnosis. But only a third were receiving treatment. Interestingly, a third actually left a suicide note, and a third had disclosed their intent before dying. And so they were reaching out. These are people who are actively saying, I'm unhappy, I have despair, I have, you know, hopelessness, but their needs weren't being met. And 20%, as I said, you know, the most significant risk factor is prior history of suicide attempt. 20% had attempted previously. So looking at mental health, what are our barriers to effective care? So according to the National Association of Mental Illness, about 350 million people globally suffer depression. In the U.S., about 61 million. But of those, close to about 13.5 million have a serious mental illness. So that would be major depressive disorder, schizophrenia, bipolar, PTSD. Fewer than half of those that are affected actually receive treatment. And it's a difficult treatment once you sort of have the interaction of mental illness and then put suicide on top of it, because it's a very complex interaction of both social, psychological, and biological features. If we lack the resources to both assess and treat a lot of the individuals, and there's a very large social stigma that's associated with both seeking treatment and receiving treatment. When you add the psychosocial aspect, that becomes even worse. So if you're looking at minorities, African Americans and Hispanics seek and use mental health at about the rate of 50% of white individuals, and Asian Americans even less, at about a third of that rate. So those are even higher risk individuals. And substance abuse also is a significant risk factor for mental illness and for suicide. So I'm going to start looking at some prevention strategies or coming up with global ideas of how we can prevent suicide. So the National Association of Mental Illness has subdivided them into universal, which reach an entire population, selective, which are high-risk, vulnerable groups, and individual, which are specific vulnerable individuals. So universally, increasing access to healthcare and to mental health care specifically is going to help from a population standpoint. affecting social change, promoting mental health and community outreach. So NAMI is very, very involved in this. They have instituted Mental Health Awareness Week, Mental Health Awareness Day, Light the Night, lots of community outreach and walks, and just making it more acceptable to be part of this community and to lead a more mental healthy type of life. They instituted World Suicide Prevention Day, which is September 10th every year. And they also identify reducing substance abuse, reducing means to suicide, and promoting responsible reporting. Selectively, so these are vulnerable groups, training gatekeepers, and I'm going to talk about a gatekeeper prevention program in a moment, and establishing helplines, and we're going to look at one of the main helplines that we have, and indicated, which are specific individuals, so community support, so having psychiatric hospitals, having support groups, treatment, and then follow-up for those leaving these healthcare facilities. Educating and training healthcare workers, and identifying and managing substance abuse and mental illness. So all of these programs need to be worked together comprehensively to institute this suicide prevention strategies. Their main goal is that suicides are preventable. So we don't need to have any deaths from suicide. I'm going to talk about whether that's truly achievable, zero suicide rate, but it certainly is a laudable goal. And achieving that also, this is a multi-sector type of education that needs to be ongoing, and along with everything else that I talked about, such as surveillance, knowing what the problem is, being able to assess and manage mental illness, means restriction, stigma reduction, and having responsible media reporting. So the comprehensive prevention includes raising public awareness, and that's what NAMI is really trying to institute. Coordinating cross-sector suicide prevention activities. So that's bringing in all the people together. So you have clergy and law enforcement and the legal system and physicians, and we can all work to and psychiatric social workers, we can all work together to institute a change. And it's not just crisis intervention, it's postvention that's going to be equally as important. So these are individuals that continue to be at high risk, and their families have a lot of stress about this. So extending suicide prevention activities beyond the immediate crisis with follow-up and referrals and continued monitoring. Very important aspect is the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. This serves all populations. When you call there, if you are a veteran, they'll actually direct you to a more guided veterans helpline. It's available 24/7. There are over 200 trained specialists to speak with, and they refer you to community resources. So in Palm Beach County, we have two resources. We have South County Psychiatric Hospital and Jerome Golden as far as treatment centers, but they also have multiple support groups that they can direct someone to. I called this once, and the wait time was about 2 minutes, which is not too bad. I gave this lecture in New Orleans when I was there. That wait time was 4.5 minutes, so almost 5 minutes, which is a significant amount of time. So I think that's good for us here. I was practicing this lecture last night, and I was sitting at my desk, and all of a sudden my phone pops on, and it says, "You seem to be having some trouble. Can I call the suicide prevention hotline for you?" I hadn't touched my phone, but it heard me talk about suicide. I don't know how many times do I say the word up to now in this lecture. 50 times, I don't know, which I find a little creepy in some respects, that my phone was actually identifying that I was a high-risk individual.
Did that, but,
iPhone. But it did. It wanted me to call the hotline. So that was and it wouldn't let me off the phone until I actually pressed no. And then it said to me, so Siri talked to me. And Siri said, you know, you seem to be at risk. Would you like me to call the hotline for you? And when I pressed no, it said, well, in the future, if you need any help, please ask me. So you never know. Okay, so this is being utilized, at least by Siri. And this is also the other half of this card. So you have, there are cards that are available or online or on the phone. And in addition to that suicide hotline, it identifies significant suicide warning signs that are amenable to both us as treating individuals and, you know, for lay people. So again, talking about wanting to die or kill oneself is a risk factor, and we need to take that seriously. Looking for a way, so ideation and means, and then all of the feelings that are associated with it. So if someone's repeatedly talking about feeling hopeless, they have no reason to live, they feel trapped, they're in a lot of pain, either emotional or physical, afraid of being a burden to someone. Those are all red flags. This is their way of opening a dialogue with you, and try and take that flag and explore. Is this something that, you know, needs to be addressed by either yourself or someone that has a little more training? So looking at high-risk groups, in college, about 15% of students suffer from depression and other mental disorders, and 10% have seriously considered suicide. So this is a very high-stress, high-anxiety time of a young person's life, and they don't always have the coping mechanisms developed to be able to address this. So the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention came up with this proactive web-based mechanism to address this specific group of individuals. It's an anonymous online dialogue via secure internet, and it's a 35-question questionnaire that takes about 10 minutes. You actually, the university has to have signed up for this program in order for their students to have access to it. And it's 35 questions that ask if they've had, uses the PHQ-9 depression scale and suicide attempts and any other related problems, anger, anxiety, substance abuse, eating disorder. And then it scores and stratifies the responses, and based on the severity or the level of acuity of this individual, then you get a response and you're directed to somebody. So whether it's a campus counselor, an online dialogue, an email dialogue, there's someone there that's able to address these individuals' risks. And this is actually a very nice program. Another one of these global or U.S. Task Force reports that came out around the same time as the World Health Organization was the Action Alliance. And this was a partnership with the National Institute of Mental Health and the Substance Abuse Mental Health Association. And they came up with this publication with the goal of reducing suicide attempts and suicides in the U.S. by 40% over the next decade. And it included both youth initiative and older individuals. And what they saw in this report is that despite all of our interventions over the last decade, that there really hasn't been a reduction in suicide. And we saw that the rates keep increasing. And they wanted to understand why and try and institute different interventions. So in looking at why, suicide and suicidal behavior is multi-determined, meaning there's interactions among both distal and proximal factors that serve as precipitants. So it's very hard to identify what from the past, what from the present is leading to this suicidal behavior. and it's multifactorial. So there's a complex interaction. There's biological factors, there's psychological factors, there's social factors, cultural factors that all are playing into this. So we know like the general epidemiology and potential risk factors, but we don't know the mutable risk factors. We don't know effective strategies for prevention. So that's what their goal was. And their initial findings were that we actually need effective strategies for primary prevention. So most suicide attempts are actually successful on the first attempt. That's about 50%. And their suboptimal mental disorder treatment that we all know. They actually were successful in instituting two DSM-5 diagnoses to be able to track the problem. So there's now non-suicidal self-injury and suicidal behavior disorder that allows us to, you know, track this long-term in an EMR. And they proposed sort of enlarging the studies or broadening studies to include neurobiological techniques, functional neuroimaging, CNS spectroscopy, polysomnography, and genetic analysis. So really broadening to be able to understand what all of these different risk factors are. This was actually an opinion paper that was in JAMA 2 months ago. So they looked at the effectiveness of interventions and saw that really effective studies are needed. But there are numerous challenges to doing to building and conducting these studies. From a logistical standpoint, suicide, even though you know the numbers are higher than we want them to be, still a rare event. So studies that have the power to detect a reduction have to be very, very large. And so sometimes that's really not achievable. It's difficult to identify some of these high-risk individuals, and there's a bias, so between study retention and withdrawals. So those who withdraw are more likely to commit suicide than those who stay in the studies. From an ethical standpoint, there are a number of challenges. So we exclude individuals with a history of suicide. In some ways, that's good. These are individuals who are very vulnerable. Do they have capacity to give informed consent or not? There's a lot of liability involved for the institution from an insurance standpoint. But on the other half, these are the individuals who are going to benefit most from being in a study, from having intervention, from long-term, you know, having effective ways to do this. Also, expectation from institutional review boards are to report deaths and death attempts as an adverse event. But if you're studying suicide, is that really an adverse event? When we have oncologic studies, death by cancer is not an adverse event. So it's almost very similar. We can almost say this is akin to that, that these are individuals that are very high risk for death, that we're trying to delay that the same way they're trying to delay death in oncologic research. And is zero suicide model achievable? So is every suicide a failure of healthcare? Also, kind of an ethical question. So looking at individual programs for prevention, up to recently, suicide prevention efforts were really devoted exclusively to identifying at-risk individuals and assessing and treating those individuals. But we see that that's really not effective. So they proposed treating suicide prevention in the same way that we treat cardiovascular disease prevention. So from a very, very broad standpoint, culturally, socially, politically, rather than individually, and continue to refine those efforts and see if that's going to be a little more successful. How do we know if a program is working or not? We want to see a reduction in suicide rate, reduction in hospitalized suicide attempts, and see that the prevention interventions were successfully implemented. So one of the programs, there are a number of programs that use gatekeepers. So gatekeepers are both professionals and lay people that are likely to interact with at-risk individuals. So community people would be clergy, law enforcement, teachers, students, ED, staff, standard physicians. And professionals are crisis line individuals, healthcare workers, social workers, and they can work together to identify and treat individuals. So there was a year-long gatekeeper training program, and during that program and in the year after, they were very good at identifying. But once that year was up, it's sort of the longer they were away from the education, the less effective it became. This is another program that also looked at-risk individuals. It's the Garrett Lee Smith Memorial Suicide Prevention Program. And it was a community-based suicide prevention program that targeted age 16 to 23. And there was gatekeeper training and mental health awareness programs, and they linked these individuals to services and programs. And what they found was that there was a significant decrease in suicide attempts. So there were 4.9 fewer suicide attempts compared to the control population, and the control population were those that were age 24 and over. But again, unfortunately, a year after that program was implemented, the reduction went back to baseline. So on the left, you see the age 16 to 23, so you see a reduction in the amount of suicide attempts in the year after implementation, and then 2 years after implementation went back to baseline. And I guess right and left are switched. On the left, those are age 24 and over. Those are the control group. And you see a modest increase and a modest decrease, so essentially baseline. So no change in the long term. This was another intervention program that looked at about over 1,500 patients, VA patients, who visited the ED for suicide-related concerns. And so there were five intervention EDs, and there were four control sites. And this occurred over a five-year period from 2010 to 2015. And the intervention was a brief clinical intervention to reduce behavior through prioritizing coping mechanisms, and then follow-up. So each individual received at least two telephone calls in follow-up, and they were tried, and they linked them to mental health postvention crisis type of interventions. So whether meeting in support groups or individual social workers. And what they saw, and this group was a VA group, so it was primarily male and middle-aged adults. And what they saw, but there was a significant reduction in suicidal behavior and increased treatment engagement in those individuals that underwent this brief intervention. So it was successful in that half of the individuals exhibited suicidal behavior, and they were more engaged post-crisis. And one of the last studies I'm going to look at is the impact of social integration. So this was using the Nurses' Health Study, very large study, so over 70,000 nurses. And what they saw was that the hazard of suicide, so the relative hazard, was lowest in participants with the highest social integration. So the more you were engaged socially and in family and friends, the less your risk of having of attempting and committing suicide. The limitations of this study is that this is all middle-aged white women, so does this apply broadly? You know, we can't apply it exactly, but at least it's a start, that social engagement is a way. And looking at different treatments for mental illness, for suicidal ideation and behavior, there's a number of different medications that are out there. There are some medications that may help with specifically suicidal ideation, so clozapine, lithium, and ketamine. There's always psychotherapy. All the psychotherapies that I listed here are brief interventions, so anywhere from 12 to 18 weeks. It doesn't mean you have to, you know, commit this person to years and years of treatment. Obviously, addressing any sort of abuse problem, so drug or alcohol, is going to be effective. And I don't think I mentioned earlier, but drug or alcohol abuse increases the risk of suicide by between 5 and 10 amounts. So, you know, reducing the abuse is going to help. And there are a number of adjunctive treatments that are available for depression and seasonal affective disorder that can be attempted as well. And the last big topic is physician suicide. So physicians have the highest rate of suicide of any other group, and it's between 28 and 40 per 100,000. We looked and we saw before that the average rate was anywhere from 13 to 14. So this is 2 to 3 times as high. And this risk doesn't start, you know, later in your career. It starts in medical school, so from the first year of medical school. These numbers are driven largely by the fact that the rate of suicide in women is almost that of males. So it's the women's suicide rate much, much higher than the national standard. Male doctors have about 1.4 higher chance of suicide, but women 2.5 to 4 times higher. So why is that? Well, overall, physicians have a very high stress, high anxiety career. This leads to a higher prevalence of mood disorder and substance abuse from all of this stress. There's a stigma for physicians. Physicians don't want to, they're fearful of seeking treatment and what that's going to do to their career. So for either mood disorder or substance abuse. The professional burden of being a physician leads to social isolation. And, you know, as a group, we're very highly motivated and highly educated. So there's a lot more successful and completed suicides by physicians. Looking at the gender distribution, we think that gender-based harassment plays a very large role in why so many women are attempting suicide. Women physicians. So the AMA saw that this was an issue, and they called for a better understanding of the patterns linked to physician suicide. So this was very recently. This is in their last meeting that they called for this new study, and they directed a committee to collect data to detect patterns that could predict suicide. And their goal is to, again, identify systemic factors and that contribute to suicide and ultimately to save lives. So they're actually looking at data from physicians in training because that's a distinct group. There is a film that came out in the last year about physician suicide. So what they say they're looking at is medical students and family physicians touched by suicide come out of the shadows to expose the silent epidemic and the truth about a sick healthcare system that not only drives our brilliant young doctors to take their lives, but puts patients' lives at risk too. So I think I would call this more of a docudrama than a fully fact-driven film, but it certainly highlights that there's an issue in our society. And the last thing I want to do is actually put a face to an individual who committed suicide. So this is a 35-year-old man who shot himself in 2010, and he called it an experimental elimination of self-preservation. So Mitchell Heisman, he worked on this thesis, essentially, so a 2,000-page thesis justifying suicide. He told his friend, so was a BA major. He received a BA in psychology, and then he lived in Boston, researched this for 5 years, told his friends and family he was doing a history thesis, finished it, The next day, dressed in white, it was actually Yom Kippur, walked into Harvard Square and shot himself. And then posthumously, this 2,000-page thesis was published. It was heavily researched. He spoke with professors at Harvard, you know, got this information all over the place, and has some very interesting probing things to say. So, first statement, there is a very popular opinion that choosing life is inherently superior to choosing death. This belief that life is inherently preferable to death is one of the most widespread superstitions. This bias constitutes one of the most obstinate mythologies of the human species. So this is a man who had such hopelessness and despair that he needed to end his pain. And I mean, you look at him and he could be anyone. He could be your neighbor, he could be your friend, he could be your child. So, you know, I just wanted to put that face out there. And I'll leave you with every word, every thought, and every emotion comes back to one core problem. Life is meaningless. The experiment in nihilism is to seek out and expose every illusion and every myth, whatever it may lead, no matter what, even if it kills us. So this is, I mean, I found this very sad. I didn't read all 2,000 pages, but I read a lot of it just to get the flavor of how much despair and hopelessness this man was exhibiting. And I think our challenges for the future are to develop more nuanced research designs that address the social in the biopsychosocial medical model and begin and to test and implement prevention interventions. So thank you very much for your attention. And if anyone has any questions, I'm available. So, sure. Yes. So I saw a statistic of close to 50% of women physicians or women in training experience some sort of gender harassment. So by their training individuals, by, you know, even patients. So it is a real problem. Yes.
So, you know, I point out that when people go to see a psychiatrist for depression, when a psychiatrist picks an antidepressant, the average number of drugs guesses about the third time. They have to go through two failures and oftentimes get to the third choice. And there's this whole field of genomics. And there, we did have a genomic speaker 3 years ago who was saying there's some genomic testing that can predict whether or not someone's going to respond to an SSRI or they're not going to respond to them, you know, and just wondering how much, you know, modern trained psychiatrists are incorporating this into their practice and how relevant it is, because, you know, people go and seek out help and then they have failures with, you know, with professionals, with psychiatrists and everything, then I think they have more despair because it takes so long to get the right treatment, and then ultimately, you know, they do more other techniques like ECT, et cetera.
Right. So two important points that you made and that I'm going to just add to very, very quickly is that genomics is one of the areas that they are focusing on. But when it comes to SSRIs, I didn't mention it, but, you know, this problem with the studies is that patients with suicidal prior attempts are most often excluded. So in the studies of SSRIs between the mid-80s to 2000, only 10% of individuals were included that had suicide attempts. And from 2013 on, none. So no one was allowed to be part of the studies. So if you don't study the at-risk population, how do you know what works? Yeah. I think that the social media, there's both positive and negative aspects. Certainly, there's a lot of that bullying aspect that we hear about. I didn't see that the social media aspect is specifically contributing to this increase rate. But, you know, it could be the studies aren't out there yet. So I really only looked at proper studies. I didn't look at, you know, Google.
I don't know if you're aware that the Palm Beach County Medical Society has set up a program where anonymously physicians, residents, interns can call the medical society anonymously and see if a psychiatrist, free of charge, for up to 5 visits.
Oh, that's amazing. I'll include it in my next round.
No. All these strategies that, you know, help lines and all these things that really sound good, you know, but there's a lot of favorable publicity. It's not really clear how well into this really works. And I guess my real question is, given all of that and the confusion and the difficulty in really trying to get accurate studies about any of these things to produce their evidence, what is the primary care physician supposed to do with their 10-minute visit? With, you know, 90 seconds or whatever it is of actual face-to-face interaction time, what are they really supposed to be doing from a screening standpoint? And what's the evidence of any that whatever they do is going to make any difference?
So from that VA study, we see that if these individuals receive aftercare, so there's part of some sort of either a group program or individual social worker, that their suicidality rate decreased by half. So you really just want to plug those people in to some further care, because they it wasn't a significant amount. This was 2 extra visits with post-carevention that really helped decrease the suicide rate. So you know, unfortunately, it's really refer them to even just a support group. Yes.
Well, to add to what you just said for primary care, the federal government has innovation networks now, and what they really believe is that if they did the pharmaceutical research and found that over 70% of all the antidepressants are in fact prescribed by primary care. So to add to your point, developing a collaborative care network where you do screening, and then the screening point, to add to what you said from the VA study, a social worker, and then you have a behavioral consultant, either a psychiatrist or psychologist or nurse practitioner, follow up. And then that way, you're getting them early in the crisis so that you can prevent suicide down the road, and then formally refer them out into the psychiatric networks. So the work's starting to be out there. It's heavy in the Northeast, and out in the West Coast, it's slow to come to Florida.
Yeah.
I found it very curious that the male suicide rate in the United States is twice that of females, because, you know, just you would think that males feel more empowered, you know, more controlled environment, women feel more harassed, and it's, you know, it kind of defies some intuitive logic, but I guess that's just.
I think it's the older individuals that really are driving this. So it's the older men who feel hopeless or have the health problems that are saying, you know what, I just can't deal with this anymore. You know, I'm going to end it.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.